The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. 51551 for your texts. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Remember Professor Robert E. Kelly back in 2017? Do you remember that? He was talking to the BBC from his home in Korea, I think it was, and he was interrupted live on air by two of his children, and then his wife came in to take the children out of his office, study, whatever he might call it, and she thought she wasn't in the picture, but she was. And it went viral, and we spoke to Robert E. Kelly about it, and he said he'd been doing very serious work for a long time, and this was the most attention he got ever in his career. Well, now, Courtney Cube, you didn't know of Courtney Cube up until 2 seconds ago, she's NBC's Pentagon correspondent, and she was on air talking about the current situation on the Syrian border and the Turkish airstrikes, and her son appeared on camera live, and she later explained that breaking news in Syria didn't line up with the preschool drop-off, so she had to bring her two children to work, and one of them appeared on telly. And it happens to us all, doesn't it, that the childcare situation falls apart and you've no option but to bring your child into work. And in the main, it goes unnoticed. But when you're NBC's Pentagon correspondent or Robert E. Kelly doing an interview with the BBC live, then sometimes you can make a name for yourself for all the wrong reasons. Anyway, that's there. I'm sure you'll spot it over the coming hours and days. Ray@rte.ie, we got an email overnight. Dear Ray, I live in South County Dublin and I dread this time of year. Every morning and every evening, all you can hear is bang, bang, bang. Children are setting off fireworks in the housing estates constantly. It is only the 10th of October and it seems to be getting earlier and earlier every year. I don't want to be a killjoy and I know Halloween is fun, but where are their parents and where do they get these fireworks? They're throwing them in front of cars, in parks and over walls. It's so dangerous. All my neighbours say they hate it, but are resigned to the fact that it's just the way it is. They all say it has nothing to do with their kids and that it's the other children from the bigger estates. My dog is terrified of the loud noises and I don't like going out for evening walks anymore in the dark. I don't have children and I know I sound like a Halloween Grinch, but does anyone else have this problem in their area? Thanks. Aren't fireworks illegal in this country? It does seem very early in the day. Anyway, I don't know how I can help you on that one. You're hardly going to go out and confront them, are you? Excuse me! Would you stop setting off those fireworks? You're scaring my dog. Thank you very much. Send them a WhatsApp message. Seemingly, according to Ofcom in the UK, and I'm sure we're similar now, 1 in 4 people make fewer than 5 phone calls a month. So 1 in 4 people make fewer than 5 phone calls a week, or a month, I should say, and everybody's using WhatsApp. I was just trying to think about how many phone calls on the phone would I make in a week. About, I'd say 5 or 6, maybe 1 a day. That's 7, is it? People chat on the phone less and less. I remember back in the day, you'd be waiting outside a phone box to make a call, and there'd be a queue. People would be ringing their girlfriends, boyfriends, brothers and sisters in America. Not anymore. They just WhatsApp constantly. I was wondering how many WhatsApp messages would people send in an average day. I was asking the people on the team who are in their 30s and they were saying that they could send over 100 WhatsApps per day. And then somebody said, well, at least 50. That's an awful lot of WhatsApping. And of course, people use voice notes as well. So it's like leaving a voice message so people can hear your voice. But increasingly, people are less likely to pick up the phone and call somebody. And that is very, very sad. I was talking to a man, I probably told you this before, but he was the head of a company. I won't name what industry he was in, but the industry involved picking up the phone and talking to people. And he got a new bunch of recruits, a new bunch of people working for the organisation. And they've discovered very early on that these people were unable to hold a conversation on the phone because they weren't used to it. They hadn't done it. They were WhatsApping and all that and texting and they don't pick up the phone anymore. Losing the art of conversation, the inability to speak to each other, even on the phone. And don't get me going on face-to-face. Anyway, Another important issue. Well, I won't do that one. I'll do this one. Today is World Mental Health Day. And there's loads of things in the papers about mental health. And I spotted an article in the Times by Paul Cullen. It's the story of Vincent Gagan. And Vincent was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And it's a real good news story because it shows you that when the system works, it works really well. So Vincent was housed by HALE, which is Housing Association of Independent Living in Ballymun in 2008. And he hasn't been hospitalised since because the people in HALE give him support. They hook him up with the local mental health team and it's all done in the community and he has a sense of independence. And that's the mental health system as it should have been, as it should be, as it was envisioned by the Vision for Change, which is now, what, nearly 10 years old, is it? Is it nearly 20 years old? So it's a good news story, Vincent Gagan, and it's by Paul Cullen there. I see that there's a survey there and people were asked, would they tell their employers if they were struggling with a mental health issue? Seemingly two-thirds of Irish professionals said they'd be too afraid to raise this issue with their boss, according to a survey. And I think that's understandable because although we have been talking about mental health for a long time now, and we've been breaking down the stigma attached to it, still, there is a stigma attached to it. And people are fearful that if they are truthful about a mental health issue they might have, that they will be seen in a negative light. And that's why I would imagine people don't tell their employers. And they're willing to say, I've the winter vomiting bug, the flu, a cold or whatever, and not admit to the real thing, which may be about a depression. And that's sad, because if we're really going to have a chat about mental health and mental illness, we need to be able to tell our employers the state of our mental health. I'm sure there are loads of people listening who wouldn't ever tell their work, no matter what was happening in their personal lives. And I can understand that completely. That's there. And we've more. We've a good news story as well about a project down in Limerick called Ease, who are helping young people with their mental health. And we're talking to Boris Hunka about that on the show today. Less important things. Dishwasher etiquette. Which magazine, which is a very reputable magazine, and they're completely independent, because any story you read now, you're going, who did the research? Who's telling that story? Because people have been paid to do research to get findings that support a certain product. So we'll keep eating beef or drinking Coca-Cola or whatever it might be. But which are independent, which is great. And they've found that things you should never put in your dishwasher. This is going to shock you, ladies and gentlemen. On this Thursday afternoon, things you should never put in your dishwasher. Kitchen knives. Huh? Chopping boards. And wooden spoons. Why shouldn't you put kitchen knives? Well, they go blunt, according to this scientific research. Wood splinters and splits. And they recommend that any wood items should be just get a quick rinse and a scrub. And other things you shouldn't put into your dishwasher are insulated coffee mugs and those fashionable reusable water bottles that everybody has now. So kitchen knives, chop boards, insulated coffee mugs, reusable water bottles shouldn't go into the dishwasher. I'm a chuck everything in person. I do rinse the plates before they go into the dishwasher. Do you? And some people say, well, why would you do that? Why would you bark if you have a dog? So why would you rinse the plates before you put them into the dishwasher? The clue is in the title, dishwasher. You're not the dishwasher, the machine's the dishwasher. Anyway, it's Matt's Week in Ireland, and they did this last year, and they did it again this year. They sent us in a jar of sweets, right? And it's about 8 inches tall. I don't know what that is in metric. It's about 8 inches tall, and it's locked with a combination lock, right? And they've sent you a letter. Well, when I say you, I mean me, us. And in the letter, there are four mathematical problems. And if you get the answers to the four mathematical problems, you put it into your combination lock and it opens the jar. Huh? Very clever. Very clever. They say, to celebrate the launch of Matt's Week 2019, the team of Matt's Week Ireland want to send you a nice big jar of sweets. Now, all you have to do is work out the single-digit answer to the four puzzles below and use the numbers to unlock the padlock. So I think I've done well. I don't want to give you all four because it'll take me forever to read them out. I have an answer for this one. I'm not certain that it is the answer. So maybe you might help me with this one. It's short. Are you listening up? Here we go. In a family, each girl has the same number of brothers as sisters, but each boy has three times as many sisters as brothers. How many boys in the family? In a family, each girl has the same number of brothers as sisters, but each boy has three times as many sisters as brothers. How many boys in the family? Can you work that out for me? I have an answer here. I don't know if it's right, and I don't want to put it into the lock. You know, I think if the other's right. Now, look, I probably have the other ones wrong, but I have three of the four numbers, and you might help me out with that. We might see if we can open it together after 4 o'clock. The big jar. I'm looking at them like big toffees. There's love hearts in there. There's gobstoppers. There's lollipops. All sorts of things. Jelly beans. Oh, we must take a picture and put that up. There you go. Hello, Ray. Bangers and fireworks can have really serious consequences over and above upsetting dogs, though that matters too. Our previous childminder now finds herself out of her house because it was badly damaged in a fire caused by a banger thrown in a window a fortnight ago, says Anne. There you go. Just got my daughter's phone bill. She just started college. Feckin' €55 over her phone plan. Well, it's great to know she's making new friends, is it not? You have to look for a positive in the €55 over the her phone plan bill. 51551, Ray at RTE.ie. Good afternoon. Yeah, I love that. Ragtag Gypsy and Tour Dum the Love. Christy Moore and Planxty. Makes you proud to be Irish. 51551, Ray at RTE.ie. That mathematical problem there. A lot of you are saying one. I don't think it's one. In a family, each girl has the same number of brothers as sisters, but each boy has three times as many sisters as brothers. How many boys in the family? And if we get it right, we all have sweets after 4 o'clock. There are two boys and three girls in the family, so the girl has two sisters and two brothers, but the boy has one brother and three sisters. Three times as many sisters as brothers, from Fionnuala and Smithfield. That's exactly what I got, Fionnuala. I think two was the answer. I think two is the answer, unless anybody can correct us on that. But that's it exactly. Well done. Congratulations. My brother was working for a company that sold mobility aids, and a woman asked if the bucket on a commode was dishwasher friendly. The lads were left dumbstruck, says Brendan. Ah, Brendan. Now, we're going live to Moiderwell in Tralee in County Kerry to speak to Tom O'Connell. He's the owner of Vintage Vendors Antique Store. And Tom has found himself at the centre of a media storm. The papers are calling it cabinet fever because a pattern on a door, on a cabinet, in Tom's shop bears a striking resemblance to the Mother of God, the Virgin Mary. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, Ray. Good afternoon. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, great to talk to you. So you're in all the papers today. Well, specifically your cabinet.
Yes.
Yeah, will you describe the cabinet to our listeners, please?
Well, it's a pretty standard Edwardian display cabinet with from around the period 1910 to 1915, that way. Would be under, you know, I mean, it would be your typical cabinet, what's about maybe €200 or €300 today. And we were using it mainly as a shop display cabinet, so it never actually had a price on it. You know, we got it for to sell other items from it.
I see. What sort of items would you have had in it?
We would have displayed china in the glass. There are two glass display areas. At each side of the famous door at this stage, but. We had, initially, the door was actually removed and spent the first 5 months of its life in the shop in a wardrobe here at the back of the shop because we said we would make use of the shelved area behind the doors. But
and I believe you put vinyl on the shelves, was it? Records,
we were
old records.
Vinyl records, yeah. We were selling vinyl records from it because it was exactly the right size for a vinyl album.
So it was in sort of, the door was in storage, and at what stage then did somebody spot what was on the front of it?
We had it out one day. I think I was trying to make a sale on this wardrobe here at the back of the shop, so we took the door out and forgot to actually put it back in. And somebody remarked on it, and you know, when it was actually pointed out to us, then we said, "Oh my God, yeah, there is, you know, there's something there is, yeah." You could envisage that. You could see that. You know?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But initially, we didn't, you know, so. But,
And it's like the Lady of Lourdes statue, that particular incarnation of the Virgin Mary. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's remarkably like it actually, and it's Yeah.
When you saw it first, what did you think to yourself?
I thought to myself, well, it's a great coincidence, and it's wood grain. That's what it is. I mean, right, you know, let's be realistic about it. I mean, it's the way the wood grain actually is in the piece of timber. You know. So,
yeah.
But look, if somebody draws whatever else out of that and they get some satisfaction from that, well, then that's okay. You know, that's their business.
And how did it come to the attention of the papers, Tom?
We had various people coming into the shop, and some people could see it, others could not. We said, okay, let's do a little piece on this on Facebook and see how this goes. And we invited people to actually offer comment as to whether they could see it or not.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, here we are, I think just 13 or 14,000 views later, and we are talking to you, you know. So.
And do people come in specifically to look at it and touch it?
Yes, they do. Yeah. So, but.
and do you engage them in conversation, Tom? Do you ask them?
I would. Yes, indeed, I would. Yeah, it's. I mean, they have, you know, they have their beliefs, and that's.
Are you a religious man?
I would say probably not the most religious man.
Okay,
in the world.
Okay, right, yes, okay. Yes, yes. And Vintage Vendors, how long are you in business?
Well, Vintage Vendors, we are Vintage Vendors is up and running now with about 11 months.
Okay.
So, and it was always an antique shop and indeed an afternoons before that. So this was the retirement plan actually, to actually take it easy for the last 10 years of my working life and have an antique shop.
And have you been into antiques all your life? It's something you've been interested in.
All my life, yeah.
Yeah, so it's turning a hobby into a business, so to speak.
Yes, and I had this desire to turn it back into a hobby again, you know.
Okay, so. You were saying there you weren't intending to sell it, but now I think there's added value with the wood grain that looks like the Virgin Mary.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, the day has been going so fast and furious that right. You know, I've been asked this question a number of times, and you know, it's something. It's a thing that never had a price on it in the shop, but we did. A piece of toast recently sold for $28,000 on eBay, and
a piece of toast that looked like it had the face of our Lord in it. Was that the one?
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah,
and that sold for $28,000.
$28,000. Yeah, and you know, that'll go all mouldy eventually, but yes. This cabinet won't. You know, so I don't know. As to the value of it. I really don't know.
And you've been getting calls all day about it, I'm sure.
All day, yes. All day. I was just looking at the Facebook account there, and in the last 20 minutes, I think he got 1,800 views in 20 minutes.
Mm.
So it's tipping along, yeah.
People see what they want to see, don't they?
They see what they want to see, yeah. And, you know, and...
We've a history, of course, you know, with the moving statues back in the the late 80s, early 90s.
And people sometimes get great sense of peace from that, and who are we to criticise them
But still, you don't want to interfere with your business, do you? You know, if it became too big.
Well. I had no idea that it was going to be as big as it became today. I mean, it's been a really crazy day, really.
You sound a bit taken aback, Tom.
I'm shocked. Yeah. I really am. Yes.
Excuse the pun, but you sound a bit mitered. Hey,
a bit mitered. Yeah. I'll tell you, the Lady of Mitherwell. How about that? Yeah.
Yeah, the Lady of Mitherwell. Yeah. Yes. And the shop owner, Mitered Tom O'Connell from Mitrewell.
That's it. Yeah, I'll have to rename the shop as the Holy Show.
Right, well, thanks for taking our call. I'm sure
thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it won't be the last phone call you'll have to answer today. But Tom O'Connell from Vintage Vendors down in Moiterwell in Tralee. Thanks, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 for your text. Now, the EASE project is Limerick-based. And it's a unique, well, not unique, but it's a special type of project. It helps young people with their mental health through music. It was founded by Boris Hunke, who joins us in studio. And Boris is a psychotherapist and a musician. So, yeah. And congratulations, Boris, because you were up in Dublin last night for the Social Entrepreneurs Ireland Awards night. And the EASE project got how much?
In total, the whole package is worth 40,000.
That's great.
So significant, yeah.
For a little project, you know, it's a small enough project in Limerick. Yeah. That's great, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
And it's great to be recognised for what you're doing.
It's validation. That means as much as, anything else.
Yes. Okay, so where are you originally from?
I was born in London. Yeah. I've been over in Ireland now 15, 20 years.
It's an unusual name, Boris Hunke, isn't it?
It is. The Boris was actually a joke on the behalf of my parents. They called the bump Boris. Right. And the name stuck.
And it stuck, yeah. Yes. And Hunke?
Hunke, that goes way back on my father's side.
And is it English or where?
Ukrainian.
Ukrainian.
Actually, but I've no connections there.
Right. Boris Hunke. Yeah, it's a great name. So which came first, the psychotherapy and the music?
The music.
The music came first.
My family are all musicians and... I've been a musician all my career.
Okay.
And I'm mainly running music programs. So I was running music, still run Music Generation, the program down in Limerick City.
Which is a very successful
project. It is. No, absolutely. Nationally, Music Generation is very successful. In Limerick, we've been flying it for 5-6 years.
And remind us how that works.
The overall program works with, it was set up by U2 back in the day, and it works in that there's funding comes nationally, which is then matched at local level. And what we did in Limerick was we looked around and we saw what was needed most of all was something which could reach the teenagers and people who weren't otherwise accessing music. So we started developing programs which focused on teenagers with rappers and rock musicians. And there's great musicians in Limerick. So we had guys from Russ and Ganna Family and Hermitage Green and all those guys coming in, working with us, going into schools and doing music. And out of that, we realised that there was something very powerful about the engagement we got with teenagers.
And you were providing a rehearsal space and the instruments for some
It's
some
a
cases.
Combination of everything. Yes, yeah. We have our centres through the... we have a centre in where we have kids come in and they write songs and they have lessons. But also we go into schools and other settings and we reach them where they are.
And you spotted something.
Spotted the power of music to engage in quite a sort of layered series of levels. It's not just about learning how to play an instrument. It was sort of getting the whole sense. And a lot of what we were doing then was touching in on mental health and well-being work. And separately to that, I trained as a psychotherapist. And so I could bring these two sides together and see, can we look at a project in which we use the power of the music and the skills of the musicians we had to actually do something which addresses the problem I was seeing in a student counselling form, which was anxiety and the coping around anxiety and people using destructive mechanisms to deal with anxiety rather than actually sort of framing it in a more healthy way.
Okay, so you said I'll marry the two.
I brought my two hats together. Yes.
And you have a glorious EASE project hat now. Yeah. So, like, when you pitched that to somebody, who did you have to pitch it to?
Initially it was about working it in the schools, and we were lucky in that we had the musicians team and we had the sort of setup of Music Generation, and there was a lot of people working in the mental health field, not just psychotherapists but psychologists and people in the HSE, and who were all working on the same sort of series of how do we solve this problem of because where the surge in mental health is, the problems are around young people. So nationally, the rates are fairly stable across generations, but in young people, there's been this huge surge, and it's addressing what's at the root of this and what can we do and how can we look at a more preventative way rather than just trying to sort of firefight the symptoms once they've appeared.
Yes, okay. So you set up the EASE project. How does it work on the ground?
It works in that we go into schools and we... Sometimes we go over a series of weeks. Sometimes we go and do an intensive day. And we go in with a team of musicians. And we have also mental health professionals. And we We use the music to engage the kids, and then as the session goes on, we use music for the kids to sort of develop their own ideas, to write their own songs, and we just explore the whole issue with music as the backdrop.
Right. And you bring in a tent, do you?
We have this year we bought a big inflatable tent, an indoor tent, which goes in, because school halls aren't great for workshops, you know. They're used as exams and basketball courts, and they have, you know, we all know what school halls like.
Yeah.
So this is a sort of large inflatable, and it pops up and it creates this sort of world, this sort of creativity world in which we can work inside it. And it
sends out a strong signal that there's something different happening here.
Well, yeah. Yeah, as does the music. So we put up this tent and they go into the tent, and then there's a performance at first, and then they introduce all the instruments. And as we're working with all that, the just ideas around anxiety and what it is.
And do they know why they're there? What I mean? Do they know this is a workshop on mental health?
Yes,
using music.
We're very clear at the outset, because also what we can't do in those circumstances is deal with any issues someone has. You know, we were very clear at the outset that this is a general thing. We could talk about how Ed Sheeran might be feeling in a song that he wrote, but it's not the space for dealing with an individual situation.
Okay,
and that we can offer people the directions where they seek the help if something's coming up.
So what do young people offer up? What age group is it?
Well, it works from fifth class upwards. We do a lot of work with TYs because of...
So 11 to 15?
The whole way up.
The whole way up, right.
At the moment, we're working with young people. There's potential, you know, anxiety does affect all of us.
And how do they start talking about it then?
Well, we start, as the session goes on, it goes from us talking to them to then us all working together, and then the young people drive it for the latter parts. We start by reframing what anxiety is, that it's not a disease, it's not a problem, it's part of being human. It's connected with drive and creativity. And it only becomes a problem in terms of coping mechanisms and not having that understanding of how to manage it and what it is. Hmm. And if you're anxious about your anxiety, then it spirals and so on. So we start off talking about panic attacks in particular, and sort of this is what's happening, this is what's prompted it, and actually it's your body trying to help you. So if you sort of accept that, then it reframes it, and that one thing can help hugely.
I'm interested in what you said there, that people are anxious about anxiety.
Yeah.
And is that sort of our fault? You know, in a way that we, like I go on talking about anxiety, that it's an epidemic of anxiety, and then somebody hears that and they go, everybody's anxious these days, and then they get anxious about being anxious.
No, it's interesting. So in terms of mental health, that in the last 10, 20 years, the big change in mental health has been that people are now talking about mental health. But that's not necessarily wholly positive, because what was just part of life is now talked about as though it's only ever a problem.
Yeah, even so mental health is pathologize it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So
it becomes an ailment.
It becomes an ailment when, if you're anxious, you're human, and vice versa. You know, it's part of who we are.
I was just saying the other day, because I was known as a kid as a worrier.
Right.
Now, if I was 11 now or 10 now, I'd probably be known as an anxious child. So suddenly I'm labelled in a.
And you'd be labelled. There'd be dangling sort of prescriptions around you. You know, and it's not helpful. It's not helpful to the young person. It's not helpful to anyone.
Hmm. So we need to rein in our chat then, do we?
I think reining in isn't maybe the thing. I think we just need to put it in the right context, because also there are some people that have very good reasons to be anxious.
Yes, of course.
And there are also some people who, for it spirals into very sort of unhelpful, unhealthy places. So there is an issue there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just being anxious is in itself not a disease.
Yes, and at the end of one of your sessions with the EASE project, what's the feedback?
It's been fantastic, because we always finish with a performance of music which the young people have written within the session. So the energy at the end, and you know, we make the point, as musicians we all know what anxiety is very carefully. Every time we're on stage we're anxious. So we sort of then have threaded that one in. So by the end we're all performing together, and so you finish on a high, and then when you come to the feedback of what's gone in, it's incredible. The messaging we've been working with has gone in a way, I think, much more effectively than if you just come and talk to people.
Mm. What about you? Do you use music as a release? as a sort of a...
I think so. The trouble with being...
productive mindfulness sort of thing.
It's, yeah, you have to sort of learn it. The trouble with being a musician is it's sort of tied in with so many things of sort of career and training, and the way music's taught often has been, in the past, it's been quite anxiety-making, you know, with exams and competitions
yes,
and the like.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So it's almost having to relearn...
to enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. Music's basically it's community, it's communication, it's connection, and so to sort of retouch in with that bit is the skill, I think.
Mm. So the EASE project, I'm sure people might be listening now, going home from school in their cars and going, can we get that for our school? How many schools have you done in Limerick so far?
Well, we've worked so far in about 30 schools. Right. Where we've come from Limerick, our team is derived from the Music Generation Limerick programme, but our aim, and with the award yesterday, is to scale up. It's a very scalable programme because there's great musicians across the country, there's mental health professionals across the country. As a model, it's one which we're hoping to expand out.
Great. Thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations again on the award.
Thank you very much.
And they're the best type of awards, aren't they? Financial ones.
Well, it helps. It all helps.
Boris Honka, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or Ray at RTE.ie. Now, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties are calling for a change in the law in order to protect victims of image-based sexual assault. At the moment, there's no specific legislation for this type of harassment, and privacy expert with the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, Elizabeth Farries, is on the line. How are you doing, Elizabeth?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much. So, in the vernacular, people talk about revenge porn, but you don't like that term.
Yeah, it's a problematic term. I just before we tackle the concept of revenge porn, I just want to back it up a little bit and point out that the substance of our submissions talks about how harassment and harmful behavior is a really serious problem, and it's gendered. And in the case of image-based sexual abuse, women certainly experience manifestations of this problem more than men. And it's an example of how inequalities experienced offline are actually being amplified online. And so when you take this terminology like revenge porn, that term is almost, you know, I feel like it almost feeds the problem a little bit. Mm. And there's other terms that are similar. I mean, there's non-consensual pornography, there's intimate image abuse. None of these terms get it quite right. And here's why. First of all, this form of abuse, it's not pornography. It's abuse. And it's also motivated for a variety of reasons that don't always just include
revenge. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The intent is really to violate someone, to violate their privacy and to violate their dignity.
So you believe that, and it makes complete sense, that image-based sexual assault is a much better term.
Yeah, and that's a term that comes from the UK, from academics McGlynn and Rackley. In their opinion, and I agree, it better covers the fact that this is non-consensual. And it's not just non-consensual at the distribution phase where people are uploading it online, but it can also be non-consensual with respect to the creation of the images themselves. So either when the pictures are taken and or when they're distributed.
So at the moment, we are dealing with laws that are over 20 years old to deal with this.
Yeah, life before the internet.
Yes.
I mean, it's a new world. It's a new sort of place that we're dealing with when we talk about these problems happening online. And when you did something that was terrible 20 years ago, you could reach sort of a relatively limited audience. Now, with like a click of your mouse or a click of a button, you can send an inappropriate image across a vast, massive audience, and that can spread really quickly. So the laws that were built 20 years ago didn't really tackle these sorts of problems because the tech, you know, it simply wasn't there.
So you're presenting to a government committee in a few weeks' time. Because there is a change in the law coming down the tracks.
Yes, we'll be talking to the Oireachtas Justice Committee on the 23rd of October, and we'll be giving advice and input about how to better tackle the harms attached to this. And, you know, there isn't really a single bullet approach to this. It's sort of a multifaceted approach that we advise.
And will you be citing specific cases when you talk to them?
Yeah, we'll talk about the experience of certain individuals, particularly in Ireland. There are people that have experienced very egregious abuse, and we'll talk about that. We can talk about examples overseas as well. This is a growing and spreading problem that has had global consequences, and it has played out in the same way as it's played elsewhere in Ireland, too, with very very harmful effects. And so I just wanted to be clear about how harmful this phenomenon is. It can be absolutely devastating. It's not simply that the images are released online, which is terrible in and of itself, but victims of image-based sexual abuse are frequently subsequently threatened with sexual assault. They can be stalked. They can be harassed based on sort of a notoriety attached to this form of abuse that they weren't seeking. And, you know, people have been fired from their jobs. Young women have been forced to change schools. And unfortunately, some victims have committed suicide subsequent to the abuse.
And at present, this outdated legislation that is governing this at the moment demands a pattern of behaviour. So if one single photograph or image is uploaded onto the internet or through WhatsApp or wherever, that doesn't count as a crime as things stand.
Yeah, that's correct. The Section 10 insists on a pattern of behavior. And as the Law Reform Commission has pointed out, you don't need a pattern for this to be extremely harmful. And so they're recommending, and we agree, an amendment to Section 10 that doesn't simply require a pattern of behavior. And the ICCL has also suggested a separate offense to be introduced in order to target image-based sexual abuse itself. Now, we suggest legislation with words of caution, though, right?
Okay.
These offenses, the legislation can't be worded so vaguely that it doesn't meet legality standards. There's a lot of rightful concern right now about the types of harassment and harmful behavior that are occurring online. But you can't simply draft a broad law saying something like, you know, harmful content is bad. That's too vague. And if a law is that vague, it could lead to, you know, censorship. It could lead to people taking down information off the internet that actually has a right to be there, that's a legitimate form of speech. That's why we're asking for very clear specificity, for example, identifying the harm image-based sexual abuse itself.
Yeah, but I suppose the problem is, and we're in the middle of it now, is that that's something that some technology that might be developed in the future may not lie within a very specific description of what exists now. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But I mean, the counter response can't be to just say broadly.
And what about just new legislation completely, as opposed to trying to add on to something that's not fit for purpose?
Yeah, we have suggested a separate offence, potentially a civil offence, together with access to legal aid so that victims can empower themselves and get direct remedies quickly. Now, to be clear, it's not simply enough to draft the laws. The Gardaí themselves, we can't have effective enforcement without a cultural understanding at the Gardaí level about what this problem means. Mm. So part about bringing out strong legislation is also, as the ICCL has recommended previously, reframing Irish policing to grounded in principles of human rights. And that reframing could include, you know, this new world that we're in that has online and gendered considerations. Oh. So part of that would mean really effective training to raise awareness, yes, in the first instance of gender rights, to raise awareness that it's not someone's fault if their images are taken and put online, to avoid things like victim blaming, and to develop and integrate training modules across law enforcement units about this.
What have they done in other countries?
That's the thing. So starting about 5 or 6 years ago, different jurisdictions have become very responsive to this problem, and we're seeing a whole host of legislation come out as a result of that. We've talked in our submissions about specific laws that have come out in England and Wales, in Scotland and Australia. So in Wales, Section 33 of the Criminal Justice and Courts Act introduced the offence of disclosing sexual photographs and film with intent to cause distress. So we would take issue with that. You know, it shouldn't simply be intent to cause distress. It should be the disclosure of the material itself. In Scotland, there's the Abusive Behavior and Sexual Harm Act that has come out, where, again, disclosing or threatening to disclose an intimate photograph or film. Mm. And in Australia, which has gotten a lot of notice, they've actually implemented an e-safety commissioner, which tackles online abuse. Again, the Law Reform Commission has looked very closely at the Australian model. The ICCL, again, would be very cautionary about putting in a broad system that sort of tackles online abuse generally without bringing in those specific crimes.
Is it likely that, you know, in the coming years that it won't be as gender specific? Because, you know, there was an example of a case in the north of Ireland where a young boy, teenager, it was threatened that a picture of him would be posted up. So what I'm saying to you is...
Yeah, isn't that terrible?
Yes.
That's awful.
Horrific, horrific.
Yeah, young boys and men experience this too, yes, certainly. Yeah, it's, yeah. But just to be clear, stats show that with respect to image-based sexual abuse, the majority of victims are women and the majority of perpetrators are men.
Men, yes.
And the qualitative research carried out by the ICCL this summer showed the exact same findings. Yeah. But let me be really clear about this. I mean, the LGBT plus community is at increased risk of various types of online harassment. One's race, one's religion, one's mental health status, one's ability. These are all risk factors for abuse
so
as well.
Any legislation has to encompass all of that. What responsibility do the Facebooks and the Twitters and the WhatsApps have?
Yeah, so part of our recommendations, we looked at, stronger and more clear laws, better education, and sort of pushing a cultural change in the Gardaí to sort of ground human rights-based understandings. At the social media company, and there was a huge buzz about this in the Oireachtas yesterday, where there was a lot of finger-pointing at the social media company. Mm. I want to be clear, we can't sort of put this entirely on their shoulders. There are levels of enforcement that are required across the board. What I think the best thing that we could see from social media companies right now is, and as we've asked in our submissions, we need these companies to publish in full their policies and their actions regarding the content they leave up and the content they bring down. And so they talk about these things very broadly to the public and to the Oireachtas. They'll cite certain specific instances, but I know they have more material back there that they're not disclosing. And we think the publication of this should be a completely normal practice. Because think about how huge these companies are. It's such a massive evidentiary set that they have that if they shared it with rights bodies, if they shared it with legislators, if, you know, the judiciary saw it, everyone could make better and more evidence-based decisions about how to respond to abusive behavior going forward. So the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression calls this radical transparency. I don't think there's anything particularly radical about it at all. The idea.
So you want them to make public what things they leave up and what things they take down and why they do that.
Yeah, so they have
what transparency. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean they have sort of brief public-facing policies that they share with everyone, but I know there are more comprehensive policies in the background guiding specific decisions, and there's stats there as well. It would be very helpful for all of us to see it, and I wouldn't be opposed to that being made mandatory on a legislative level.
And do you think they should be, Facebook and WhatsApp, do you think they should be seen as publishers as opposed to platforms?
Yeah, that's a complicated argument that came up in the Oireachtas. I mean, I would say Facebook is both a publisher and an intermediary. So when Mark Zuckerberg, you know, publishes a note saying, guys, we're going to do this better, our content moderation is going to get better all the time, here's what I think about it, and here's what we're going to do, that's an example of something that Facebook publishes. Now, when someone gets online and says something nasty to someone else or shares a really terrible picture, I don't know if I would be comfortable calling the social media companies publishers in that sense. Because again, it's, if you're going to make that broad wholesale label for an entire population, you're taking away a lot of protections for bodies that share information.
But most people share benign information, and so it doesn't apply to them. If they were seen as publishers, they'd be a lot more responsible for what goes through their platform, goes through their system.
Calling them a publisher sort of puts a legal impetus on them and a liability on them if they don't respond in a certain way. And it's a very strong task to take someone like Facebook to, if there aren't clearly defined laws for others even. So in the case of image-based sexual abuse, if we don't have a clear law to guide, say, law enforcement or judges, for example, why would we necessarily expect Facebook to do a better job? Why are we putting that burden on their shoulders alone? It's a multifaceted problem that requires responses at a lot of different levels.
Okay, and it's something we'll be talking about again and again and again. For the moment, Elizabeth Farries from the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, thanks so much for taking our call. Thank you.
Thanks.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
5151 or rayatrte.ie. Now, the people in Matt's Week, Ireland, sent us in a big jar of jellies, but it has a combination lock on it, and they gave us four mathematical problems that we had to solve. And using the answers from those four mathematical problems, you open up the jar and you've access to all the lovely sweeties inside. Laura's with us. We're going to talk to Laura in a moment. She's on the cover of the Irish Times today. So the first one was 20 jelly beans, a mix of 6 red and 14 yellow ones. How many yellow jelly beans would you have to eat in order to end up with a mix of 50% yellow, 50% red? I think that's 8. So I'm going to put 8 into the thing. There you go. 8 is in there. Yeah, that's the top one. The second one is too long to read. It's about people lying to each other at a table. A lady suddenly says there are 7 people at the table. Not true. She's a liar. There's only 6. So I think the first person is telling the truth. So I'm going to put 7 in there. 7. And there you go. And then the one that you helped me with, as in you, the listeners. In a family, each girl has the same number of brothers as sisters, but each boy has 3 times as many sisters as brothers. Are you with me, Laura? How many boys in the family? Well, it's 2 boys, you see, because one guy would say, I have 1 brother and then I have 3 sisters. Do you see what I'm saying? Yes. Whereas a girl would say, I have the same numbers of brothers and sisters, 2 and 2. So I think the answer is 2 there. And you're not the only one who's not following. I think a lot of people have switched off already because mathematical problems create hassle for an awful lot of people. And finally, this number is twice 1/5 of 1/2 of 20. I reckon that's 4. And I'm going to put 4 in and then see if it opens. No, I'm wrong. So there you go.
It was a wild guess.
There you go, it doesn't open, so I'm all wrong. So if somebody will have to help me out there. That's very embarrassing. My maths teacher is going to be on to me, Mr. O'Toole. This number is twice 1/5 of 1/2 of 20. So 1/2 of 20 is 10.
Yeah.
1/5 of that is 2. And that multiplied by 2 is 4, yeah. So one of them is wrong there somewhere.
Something else has gone wrong.
Anyway, we'll come back to that.
Don't look at me, I teach yoga, I don't do
right,
that.
Laura Farrington, as I say, is on the cover of the Irish Times today, a photograph taken by Frank Veal, and you're doing yoga with a dog.
We're doing yoga with puppies, yes.
Right, explain yourself.
So I suppose to start, our company goes into companies around Dublin and we deliver all kinds of wellness activities and classes. Some is yoga, some is Pilates, and the Dogs Trust wanted to bring some wellness to the employees out there. So they got in contact with us and together we developed this puppy yoga class. So there's kind of 2 benefits to it. One is the well-being of the employees. They're getting to do some yoga. They're getting time out of their day. And then secondly is for the socialization of the dogs. So one thing Dogs Trust pride themselves on is the socialization of the dogs. They really prioritize that. So the dogs got to mingle with us and the employees got to take 40 minutes out of the day, right, which was nice for them.
And you've 3 very cute puppies in the picture there.
There's about, I think there was about 5 or 6 actually.
Yeah.
And they're very small. They're only 6-week old terriers that had been abandoned, but they were very good.
So this was bespoke for the people out in Dogs Trust.
Yes.
You don't normally do this. Is this something that could take off, do you think?
I think so. I did a couple of classes in the States.
Right.
That is along with goat yoga is quite popular.
Goat yoga?
Yeah, that's quite popular over there.
With a living, breathing goat?
Yeah, so they just let the goats wander around as you do yoga. And they
you're making that up,
No,
Laura.
I'm not. You can Google it.
Because we had Brendan Courtney and his partner in and they went to London to study, you might know what this is, but it's a yoga based on the postures and positions of animals.
Yes. Oh yeah, animal flow.
Animal flow, that's exactly it.
Yes, that's really popular as well.
Yeah. So just explain that to me again, because I was trying to figure out what Brendan told me and I couldn't remember.
So it's just based on different animal postures. So for instance, you will be, let's say, a dog and you'll be kind of in downward dog posture.
Yes, yes. Well, we all know downward dog. Well, most people do.
Yeah, and any kind of like cobra pose, you'll be on your belly in the shape of a cobra.
Uh-huh.
Some teachers go as far as to make you make the noises in class. So it can be quite funny.
And it's called animal flow yoga.
Animal flow yoga, yeah.
Right, and there's goat yoga.
There's goat yoga, there's puppy yoga, and there's also wine yoga, which is really, really popular.
Right.
That's where you drink wine.
And do yoga.
Yes.
Yeah. How long are you a yoga teacher?
I'm a yoga teacher now about 3 years, 3.5 years.
Right, okay. There's a huge demand, isn't there?
Huge, and it's only getting bigger and bigger. I suppose.
And do you find the sort of the profile, the age profile of your clients is changing?
Yes. So obviously yoga is now very mainstream. So younger people are into it straight off the bat. It's getting more popular among people in their 40s and 50s, 60s, 70s.
Men?
men are getting into it as well. Yes. You'll find in companies, it'll be a 50-50 split. So it'll be guys and girls. Yeah. Because it's not just the exercise you're getting, it's the mindfulness side of things as well. So it's a great alleviation for stress and anxiety.
And it's the stretching.
It's stretching, yeah.
Yeah. So if a dog's doing yoga, how does he do downward dog?
A dog. Well, now I can't speak dog and I can't instruct a dog. But they tend to do that naturally. I don't know if you have a dog yourself.
I do have two dogs.
Yeah, so have a look at them when they wake up in the morning. You'll see them stretch. Yeah. They'll do up dog and then they'll do down dog.
Well, here's the problem. Because I was trying to do yoga at home a few years ago when one of them was a pup and he just wouldn't let me at it.
No?
No, because he was crawling all over me.
Oh, yeah, they tend to do that.
That is a problem, yes. So how did that work out in the dog's trust?
Oh, they were crawling all over us.
Oh, right. You didn't mind that?
It was lovely. It was lovely. They were just jumping all around the place. They were mingling with us and with each other. So there was no issue there.
I met a man in his 50s from somewhere rural in Ireland a few years ago. And we were having a chat and we were talking about the aging process and, you know, keeping up running and not doing running and going to the gym and all that sort of thing. And he had reluctantly gone to a local yoga class in the parish hall.
Yeah.
And he said it transformed his life.
So he got addicted.
And he said to me, when you go back on the radio there, tell all men over 50 to do yoga.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially the older you get, you need to make sure that you're looking after your joints, the muscles in your body, because they just get naturally tighter.
Yeah.
So it's never more important to do things like yoga and even Pilates, strengthening your back and your core.
What's the difference between Pilates and yoga?
Pilates is very much core based. So it strengthens your lower back and your core. And then yoga is, so there's 9 different styles of yoga.
Right.
And yoga is a bit more about the, along with the physical, it's about the mindfulness side of things. So in a yoga class, you will generally always do a little bit of meditation, a little bit of mindfulness practice, and then stretching. So there's 3 components to yoga.
Have you been abroad to study or did you do it?
Yes, I was actually working in the corporate world, a big telecommunications company for about 7 years, very stressed, very anxious, decided to leave, went to India, and the rest is history. We set up the company and here we are.
Right.
So big change.
How was that? I'm fascinated by that. What age were you when you made the change?
I was 28.
Right.
So I was very embedded in the company I was in. I was doing very well, but I was just feeling stressed and anxious. And when I was in school, there was no mindfulness practice. I didn't even realize that that's what I was. I was stressed and anxious. But it was at the point of it beginning to affect my work life, my daily life. I couldn't really clock off from work, which I think everyone can relate to. So I tried yoga in Dublin, tried a couple of random classes, didn't really get into it. I was definitely not a very mindful person back then. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to go to India, the birthplace of yoga. If I don't connect with the practice there, then it's definitely not for me. I'm just not a very mindful person. But then I did. I fell in love with it.
But did you go to India specifically to learn how to teach yoga to come back and set up a business?
No.
No.
I went to India because I was stressed and anxious and I wanted to get out of Dublin. And I had fully intended to go back into the corporate world. But I just felt so good after 2 months over there that the thought of going back into that environment just, it wasn't the right move for me at the time.
Mm.
But had I known then what I know now, still be yoga, meditation, mindfulness practice. I just didn't have anything to turn to at those times.
So do you think what you would have stayed on where you're, what you were doing?
Oh, for sure.
Would you?
Yeah.
You just would have done all those things as well?
Yeah, I just would have incorporated them into my daily life, into my work life. 100% I would still be in that corporate life. Not to say I absolutely love what I'm doing now. I'm so glad I found it. It's amazing running your own business, but I just didn't have the tools back then to help myself.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people feel that way. I think wellness is huge now in Dublin and you see people doing all these weird and wonderful things, whether it's running or yoga or Pilates or meditation sessions, trying to figure out how to find that work-life balance.
Mm. And what do your former work colleagues think?
Well, they knew me back in the day. So I was very different back then in terms of how I looked at wellness. I was probably in the pub every Thursday, Friday, Saturday. That was my way of alleviating stress, like most people, you know. But now I have a very different set of tools.
And
that
do you
I
still
use.
Drink?
I do. A little bit, though. Not as much.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of wine with wine yoga.
I've never tried that. I must try that wine yoga.
It's fun. Well
what are you going to do with that brilliant picture from the cover of the Irish Times? Are you going to get it framed? Or
we're going to get it framed. We're going to schedule a couple more puppy yoga classes as well. A lot of people have been asking.
Right.
And yeah, so we're
cow yoga?
Sheep yoga? Well, we definitely have a lot of them here. It would be easy to do, but I just don't know how that would work.
Well, definitely, you could get a pat on the head. You want to be careful.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Laura Farrington, thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
And it's Umbrella Wellness is the organisation.
Yeah, so if you want to find out more about the puppy yoga classes or any kind of yoga, it's umbrellawellness.ie, or you can follow my Instagram for an update, which is Irish Yoga Girl.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Can't get over, I didn't get into Jarrah's Sweets. Anyway, I'll come back to that tomorrow. Now, Samantha Rawson, our dog expert, joins us in studio. Good afternoon, Samantha.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Have you ever done dog yoga?
No.
Yeah, see, it's dog half hour now. From dog yoga to dog expert.
Good dog day.
You're very popular. People, there's a lot of dogs out there, and a lot of people have issues with their dogs.
Yes, yes.
I wonder what the population of dogs in Ireland is.
Too many.
Too many. I thought you were going to say 2 million. Too many.
No, too many.
Too many dogs.
Too many. Because, you know, I know it's World Mental Health Day, but people have very busy lives and dogs are getting left out.
Yeah.
So dogs take an awful lot of time. So unless you have time,
just
don't get
one. Dogs, you saw that during the week. And we spoke to, it was research from Canada, but we spoke to somebody from Tilda, that's a longitudinal study in Trinity, about the positive effects that dogs have on people who are aging.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, obviously, if you're retired, you do have time.
Yes.
So a dog at that time of your life is a fantastic contribution. But if you're busy with family and children and pick up and leaving and here, there and everywhere, dogs can sometimes add a bit of stress.
Yes, and instead of take it away,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, right. The air's matter. I have a German Shepherd, puppy male, 11 weeks old. How do I, one, stop him snapping? Two, eating his poo? Three, stop him pooing in the house? Thanks, Alec.
First thing, research the breed. You have the dog now, so it's a bit late. But German Shepherds are working dogs. They are, they used to flock guard sheep and they're now used as guard dogs. They are very bitey in the early months. And it's not really aggressive biting. It's just they're very chewy and mouthy and they love to stick their teeth on things. So provide lots of alternative chew items other than your hands and don't reprimand him for snapping. Sometimes people will, you know, maybe try and give a dog a tap on the nose or, you know, kind of use their hands to say, stop that. That actually makes your hands more attractive and it becomes a game. So your hands then become a toy. So keep your hands well away from the dog's mouth and try and distract them.
Okay. Eating his poo and pooing in the house.
House training, we spoke about house training the last day. House training, you really need to give the dog a small room that you contain the dog in, so that his bed is quite small and his bathroom is large. So his bed is in one corner, say a utility room, and you cover the whole area in paper and slowly you remove the paper and try and put a soiled piece of paper out in the garden so a scent is out there.
Okay.
But you can't have a puppy who's not house trained in a large kitchen because to them the whole kitchen is a bathroom. So you keep them in a small room and that's where crates come in, but a utility room with a baby gate is just as useful.
Good luck with that, Alec. I have a Westie who's normally placid and calm, but when I start the Hoover, she goes berserk.
Okay.
She tries to attack the head of the Hoover and even when I stop the Hoover she remains barking at it. Sorry, we shouldn't laugh, Mary. Sorry about that.
That's great if there's nothing on TV. Take out the Hoover. terriers are...
Terriers.
They're terriers, yeah. Westies are terriers.
You're a terrier, yeah.
So they like to go after things and especially things that make noise. And dogs don't know what a Hoover is. So suddenly this thing is moving around the living room making noise and probably has a whirly brush on the end. I don't know what kind of Hoover it is. But it suddenly is animated. So a dog doesn't know it's a Hoover. You know it's a Hoover. So the best thing to do in kindness to the dog is to put the dog out of the way when you're hoovering.
That's easy. Okay.
And turn the Hoover off.
That's straightforward. How to stop one-year-old pup from running away when he's off the lead. Stop him jumping up playfully on people and stop him excessively drooling in the car. Otherwise, he's perfect.
Oh, God. Sounds like stopping a dog.
There's a lovely sense of humour about these.
You can't stop him from being a dog. He's going to do all those things, unfortunately. Stop him running after people. You have to teach him a bit like a small child. If you had a toddler, you wouldn't let them run, you know, 10 feet away from you. So you've got to teach them you're only allowed to run so far. So they're always on a line. So if I have puppies, they're always on a line. Now, they might trail the line or I might hold the line, but they are never allowed run too far away from me. Because a dog that's allowed to run too far away from you, it becomes an elastic band that eventually snaps.
Right.
So that your influence of control is gone.
So they're not on a lead.
They're trailing in line.
Say
like a horse lead rope or a piece of rope or something. So say about 10 feet long.
Yeah.
So if the dog gets a little bit beyond you, you can catch up with it and stand on the line.
This is when you're training.
Yeah.
Him. Yes. Yeah,
But the whole idea is to never allow the dog to get that far away from you.
Okay.
Do you get me?
Yeah, but then when you take them off the lead.
Well, then they know it's a habit.
Aha.
Think
right,
about
okay.
your toddler.
Right, fine. Yeah, yeah.
It's a habit. So
jumping up playfully on people.
Again, obviously it does that when it's off the lead and it's running away having a bit of crack. That would also say to me that the dog doesn't find the owner as interesting as it should. So right. You need to do lots of play around the house.
You need to be more interesting.
Absolutely.
And drooling in the car.
Well, that's anxiety, and hopefully the puppy will grow out of that. But dog crates in cars are a good idea because it keeps the dog contained. Again, cars are mobile. There's things moving outside. There's things moving inside. So to keep the dog in a small, dark space so that it can handle it. It doesn't have too much to take in.
Yeah, when you think about it, like, you know, evolution and all that, like, it must play with their head, havoc with their brains.
I tell people that sometimes a dog living with us is like us landing on Mars.
Yes, yeah.
It's like, you know, they don't know what hooves are, they don't know what cars are, they don't know what plastic bags are. They're dogs. Yeah,
they're dogs. Can you ask Samantha, please, we have a 3-year-old Westie who constantly barks at the TV anytime there's an animal on it. Whether that's a cartoon or real life, she's always done it from young. Any ideas, as we have a new baby now and it doesn't help with the dog barking?
Okay, I don't mean to sound disregarding, but I would just simply put the dog out of the room while the television is on. If there's animals on, you know the dog is going to do it, so take some control and management, and you see the animal on TV, put the dog out of the room. Because again, the dog has been wound up for nothing. The dog doesn't understand that this is on
not
television.
A real animal,
so
yes.
Again, it thinks it's chasing something and gets vexed and frustrated and then goes a little bit lula. So you might think it's funny, you might not think it's funny, it might be very annoying, but the dog is not actually enjoying itself. It might look like it's enjoying itself, but it's not.
But then you see the fire, particularly now as we get into winter.
Yeah.
Like, dogs love, and there's nothing nicer than seeing a dog snooze in front of a fire.
Yeah, that's if it's tired,
it's
right?
Postcard perfect.
Yeah, it is postcard perfect, but that's how after it's had a long walk or a good play or, do you know what I mean? That its brain is calm.
Yeah.
A dog's brain has to be calm before it can snooze beside the fire.
Mm. And that's a good point, isn't it? That certain breeds of dog need exercise, and if they don't get it, they don't react well.
Yeah, well, it's like, you can imagine if we weren't ever taken out, if we were just stuck in our house in our garden. I don't care if your garden is 3 acres, you're still stuck in your house. So you need to get out and see the world, and sniffing is like reading the newspaper. Do you know what I mean?
That's brilliant. Dear Samantha, we had a new baby recently, and our dog, who is like our firstborn baby, seems to be depressed about it. Ooh, jealousy. It's not only in my head, as our friends and relatives have commented on it. My question is, what can I do to cheer her up? She's so good and doesn't interfere with our baby, but she is so sad.
She doesn't say what type of dog it is, Ray. And I would think that there's an awful lot of anthropomorphism going on.
You better explain that.
That the woman is kind of putting human emotions on the dog. That she might appear to be sad, but she might be a little bit perplexed or, things are out of sorts for a little while. She's adjusting. You know, it takes us all time to adjust to new situations.
Dogs can't be jealous. Is that what you're saying?
They can be jealous, absolutely. Yeah. But being sad is a different thing. Do you know what I mean? So I would need more information on that. But if she honestly feels the dog is sad, that when maybe the baby's asleep, maybe she can have the dog on her lap and do some snuggies or play ball with him in the sitting room or whatever. You know, while the baby's asleep, that's your time to engage with the dog if you're worried about your dog.
And has the dog got the smarts to know then that when the baby's up, that it's her time?
They could do.
A clever dog could.
And if you're seriously concerned about it and you have the financial resources, maybe hire a dog walker, you know?
Right. How much would a dog walker be?
Oh gosh, Ray, now you're asking the wrong person.
My dog is driven daft by the bangers. We had an email at the beginning of the show, actually. My dog is driven daft by the bangers at night time. He's genuinely scared and keeps barking. Is there such a thing as earplugs for dogs?
Not that I've heard of.
All right. How can I keep him calm over the next 4 weeks in the lead up to Halloween?
I would try and give him access to a small dark space, or let him go upstairs onto the bed or into the bedroom, anywhere that the dog feels safe. Somebody was saying to me outside that they give their dog their pajamas. So again, you know, your duvet or something with your smell. It's a bit like, you know, if your lover goes away, you might wear their sweatshirt.
Yes.
Do you know? So to give the dog any kind of sense of safety, and always in fear-based situations, especially Halloween, I would say rules do not apply. So if the dog is not allowed upstairs or he's not allowed on the sofa, those rules don't apply when the dog is fearful.
Right. We had two wonderful family dogs until recently. Our younger dog, Bobby, died from cancer. Sorry to hear that. An awful time for the whole family. Anyway, the older dog, Pete, has since gone downhill and seems to be pining for Bobby. We feel it's too soon to get another dog, but would it be good for Pete if we did? He's miserable and is not his normal bubbly self.
Again, I wouldn't recommend it, because then when do you stop? I had a lady a few years ago that had Great Danes, and every time one died, she replaced it. And then she rang me because she was in her 70s and said, Samantha, what'll I do? I'm not getting another
one.
I'm not getting another one. So if you go down that line, it can certainly help, but at some point you've got to, you know, it got to come to an end. So I would say maybe give the dog more company if you want another dog, because sometimes a dog is pining for an individual dog for that relationship. It's not pining for a dog.
Yes.
Do you know, it's lost its companion. You getting another dog is not giving it, you know what I mean? It's like if you lose your wife and somebody brings over another woman and says, there you go.
I'm not going to comment on that.
But it doesn't work like that. He's pining for that particular dog.
Yeah.
Not necessarily another dog. So I would certainly take your time on that. And grief dogs do go through the grieving process. And as we know, it's a long process. So I would give it time.
Okay. Now, you will return in the future, Samantha Rawson.
I will.
Just
to
let people know, we did get a statement from the Department of Justice on the Irish Civil Liberties Council thing, and we will read that out tomorrow. We've run out of time today. Samantha, thank you very much. Thank you. Sarah McInerney's on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday.